This is Be the Story. How do you write moody stories? How do you imbue your prose with that sort of kind of overwhelming, thick emotion? It's all about invoking emotions in your audience. Over the next couple of weeks, I want to look at different ways of investing emotion into your story. Setting the mood this week on Be the Story. Welcome to Be the Story, celebrating stories and those who tell them. I'm Tim King. I'm back after a little hiatus. Taxes are done, and the government didn't ravage me too badly this year, although I never look forward to tax time. But since the last podcast on BeTheStory.com, I've started a series, or at least the introduction, to a series on the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, the characters. I'll go through each of the four characters and then finish off with a conclusion. And the reason I'm doing this is not because I think the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants is the best literary novel ever written, because it's not. And not because I think it's a good story, even though I do like the story a lot. The reason I'm doing this series is because Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants character analysis is the single solitary most popular search phrase that brings people to BeTheStory.com. Believe it or not, someone's obviously using that novel as a class assignment. I've also been kind of lax in posting over the past couple of weeks because I started a professional and career blog on my other site. And so I appreciate your understanding in helping me get that off to a great start. It's about software development, leadership, and entrepreneurship, which are three of my passions. I also talked about Holly Lyle's website. If you're not familiar with Holly Lyle or her resources for writers, definitely check out her website at hollylyle.com. That's H-O-L-L-Y. L-I-S-L-E. Also on BeTheStory.com, character ideas through substitution. That is taking one aspect or one reaction and plugging it in for another reaction in a character. And a couple of miscellaneous posts. If you haven't checked out Somewhere on the Masthead, that's a blog, it's really good reading. And in particular, he recently did a whole series, multi-part story, you know, true documentary story that happened to him that really had me on the edge of my seat. So there's a link to that at BeTheStory.com. And lastly, a short inspirational tale from Kin Claver's blog. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name correctly or not, but a blind man's new words get new results. This just underscores, if you read this anecdote, it really underscores the power of story to move us and to affect us. We also have lots of comments Both Pamela Slim and Glenda Watson Hyatt wrote to thank me for mentioning their interview. Pamela Slim from the Escape from Cubicle Nation blog interviewed Glenda Watson Hyatt regarding her autobiography, I'll Do It Myself. And if you haven't checked out Escape from Cubicle Nation, that is one of my favorite blogs. I highly recommend it. He says, as though his recommendation were actually worth anything. No, seriously, though. That's one of the blogs that I actually look forward to reading every day. Joseph Greenway wrote in response to an early episode of Be the Story, in which I talked about Robert Heinlein's The Moon is a Harsh Mistress and The Gilmore Girls, and compared them. He wrote, "Wow, that's the first time I've heard the work of Robert Heinlein being compared to The Gilmore Girls." Yeah, I guess they are usually kept in different genres. But now, is it just me? Am I just cross-genre? Or are maybe genres not quite so meaningful as writers sometimes think? What are your thoughts on that subject? We also have an audio comment from Kayendi on the episode regarding story games.
Hello, Tim. Kayendi here. Do you know how strange it is to hear your name mentioned on a podcast? Well, maybe you do. Anyway, I listened to your second Anatomy of a Story Game episode today, and I found it just as interesting as the last one. Like you, I doubt I'll ever venture into story games, but since my eldest has his heart set on designing computer games when he grows up, I think it'll be good for him to listen to. We both played the detective game that you linked to in your last episode. I constantly felt the need for hints, while my eldest kept boasting that he didn't need any, apart from the one I accidentally gave him. He enjoyed the game, however basic it was, and expressed an interest in trying to make one himself. I'll keep you posted on that, though. At the moment, he's more into playing games than designing them. The reason I needed all those clues is that I just don't have the patience for games like this, which is probably why I'll never really play Sims. I just like designing houses and creating characters. Episodes like this one remind me what I like about your podcast most. It doesn't matter which media you use, be it books, films or games, hell, music even. They all center around the same thing. Storytelling. We have a story to tell and we all use the same tools. It's just the end results is different. Keep up the good work. Oh, and don't worry about your pronunciation. Kayendi, Kayendi, it's all fine. Bye!
Thanks, Kayendi. I wish Elvis the best of luck in making his own game. Maybe I'll try to get a post in about some game development resources on the web. One book that I've read on designing games that I really liked was Game Design, The Art and Business of Creating Games by Bob Bates. And maybe I'll post a little kind of mini overview of that book. Gosh, that's a bunch of maybes, isn't it? Actually, I do hope someday to be a story game designer. I just don't expect that I'll be entering in through the front door, because in order to do so, I'd basically, well, I'd have to become a college student again. I don't mean that I'd have to go back to college. I mean I would have to become inexperienced as a software developer. I would have to be willing to do things that I consider patently unprofessional. And at least that's the way it is from what I can tell in most of the video games industry. So I'm just not cut out for that. Let's take a little break. And when we come back, we'll talk about setting the mood with expectations.
Hi, this is Ron from Griddle Cakes Radio. Are you looking for a family, work-safe podcast that'll make you smile? If so, swing by griddlecakes.com. Once there, you'll hear things such as a musician's trade organization threatening to sue Thomas Edison over his phonograph record machine. They've made their living this way their entire careers, and you, Mr. Edison, you have taken this living away.
Yeah. I'm sorry you feel that way.
Well, we can't sit back and allow this piracy to go on any longer. Here.
What's this?
It's a cease and desist letter. You are to stop manufacturing phonograph record machines immediately.
You're kidding, right?
Am I on candid camera?
Or, did you ever wonder what animals actually do at night?
Wait. No. Cut. 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 Stop. What are you doing? You sound like a bunch of animals.
But we are animals.
But don't you see? We don't have to be. We can be much better than animals. We can be musicians.
Griddle Cakes Radio. Exploring the lost art of audio storytelling. Check us out at www.griddlecakes.com.
One way that I've seen authors set the mood for a story is with expectations. And by expectations, I'm talking about what you as the reader, what I as the reader, think is going to happen. Not just what I think is going to happen, but what I think could happen. So, for example, I recently read C.J. West's novel, Sin and Vengeance. And this is a thriller. Edge of your seat, you're just glued to the page, you have to read on to find out what's going to happen next. It's because in the very first chapter, he sets the tone by making it clear what the character is capable of, one of the characters. And so once he establishes the absurd depths to which this character will go, and then once he makes clear how capable this character is, and once you see this connection, basically the character terrorizes you. I mean, you just feel so helpless in the face of this character. You feel terrified for the protagonist because, of course, you know, I'm sympathizing with the protagonist, and it's horrible. Also thrilling. So that feeling of suspense, of, you know, utter oppression. That's one example of what I'm talking about by setting the mood. I'm talking about manipulating the audience's emotions. So you have this kind of a memory of a feeling, or at least that's what I equate with mood, is when I think back to a particular story, I have a memory of a feeling. So how do you create really moody writing? Well, it's not just through the words, it's through the storyline. And one way that we can do this is to set expectations regarding what's going to happen, or at least what could happen in the future. Sticking with the horror genre for a moment, I remember H.P. Lovecraft's story, The Shunned House. And I believe if you Google, I'll Google for it and see if we can find an online text. Even though I believe it's still under copyright, owned by the estate of H.P. Lovecraft. In any case, in this story, Lovecraft, in the first few paragraphs, he starts to build up this image of this haunted house. And the thing about this haunted house is that people die there. No one can live there because they die. And so he sets up this image of this house, that something is terrible there. We don't have to understand what it is, but he slowly builds up this horrific element. And H.P. Lovecraft was just a master at doing this, picking one horrific element and then slowly building it up and building it up until you are so wrapped up in the plight of the characters. So in this story, The Shunned House, the main character, I mean, you just know something absolutely terrible is going to happen to him or could happen to him. And so when I remember The Shunned House, I remember this feeling of just utter terror. The X-Files used to do this a lot, too. Between Mark Snow's brilliant soundtrack and, well, now we talk about music like that and say it's moody, the music is moody, and associate the music, of course, with that feeling of kind of like just deeply emotional and horrifying. But really, what made the X-Files feel that way was not just the music. The music by itself is just music. I mean, you know, we listen to moody music, but without anything to associate it with, an image or a feeling to associate it with, it's just music. Music by itself is an abstract art form, right? You can take the same music, put it in two different stories, and get two completely different feelings from it. So the music can be used to heighten the moods that are already there. But how do you define what the moods are and actually introduce them so that they can be felt? And with the X-Files, you know, we knew that Mulder and Scully were seeking out some horrific thing, you know, whatever they were doing in that particular episode. So in any particular episode, they're researching or they're going into some dark place. And again, I'll talk about setting in a future part, but, you know, they're going through here and I always felt as if at any time something could jump out at them or something could, you know, just attack them or something would happen to them. Especially when they split up. Why did they split up? I know it's more efficient, right? You have one person go off and take care of this thing, another person take care of the other thing. But that always terrified me because I knew that if they were apart, then something really bad and supernatural could happen to one of them and there'd be no evidence and no witnesses. So, now, I know we've been talking about horror and thrillers, you know, kind of the scary aspect to moodiness. But fundamentally, and usually I guess this is what we mean when we say moody, you know, how do I write really moody prose? Or, you know, how do I make something really moody? You know, we think of anger, we think of all the negative emotions. But, you know, fundamentally, there's no reason why the same kinds of techniques can't be applied to create other feelings as well. by showing a little bit of success. You know, the protagonist wants to accomplish something, meet some goal, and he gets one step further on his way to that goal, and he's very happy about it. That can be very exciting. I mean, this is something that in our real lives we experience all the time. And when we accomplish that step with someone else, it's a shared excitement. It's a shared accomplishment, which makes it even more important to us. So, you know, there's by setting the expectation that we can do this after all, even though we're not there yet, look, we've proven that we can do it. We've proven that we can get closer. You know, we've proven that we can go down this path. That can create its own set of emotions. Another great example is Laura Whitcomb's novel, A Certain Slant of Light. In this story, the main character is a ghost. She's dead. And as a ghost, she can see things around her. She can hear, but she cannot feel physical objects. She can't taste. She can't smell. And she can't communicate with other people. She's all alone, basically. Until one day, someone does see her and is able to hear her. And the reason why is that this person is a ghost who has found an empty human body, not a dead body, a body that's still alive, but someone whose soul has left his body. So our main character then, we feel very hopeful that she can also find someone to inhabit. And when she finally does, we revel in all of the experiences and the deep connection that she makes with this other person. And we also are very fearful of what will happen when she has to leave the body, when they both have to leave these bodies. Or alternatively, we look forward to the possibility that they might find some way to continue in this existence. So there are a whole other set of conflicts that go along with this, but there's this very deep emotional string of emotions that Laura Whitcomb takes us through as the characters progress in the story. Let's take a quick break and then try to write our own flash fiction that uses expectation to create mood.
Hi, I'm Larry Lessig of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We've been fighting for your free speech rights for more than 15 years now. So join us so we can accomplish even more. Go to EFF.com and become a member today. Thanks a lot.
Okay, guys, roll to hit the Vampire Gazebo. You hit.
Hey, guys, what are you doing? Role-playing?
Oh, no, it's that guy.
No, we're not doing anything. We're just watching TV.
Aw, that's too bad, because I brought along my new gaming girlfriend.
Hello, boys. Mind if I max out on charisma?
Whoa! Hey, did you get that hot gaming girlfriend from listening to Gamer the Podcasting?
Yeah, of course!
Gamer the Podcasting does not actually get you a hot gamer girlfriend. What it actually does is give you useful advice on tabletop role-playing, live-action role-playing, and all other forms of role-playing games. Sometimes we talk about other games. We can do whatever we want. It's our own podcast. Visit us on the web at www.gamerthepodcasting.blogspot.com.
Hello, I'm Sarah Deutsch of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. If you speak your mind in your blog or podcast, you need EFF. Protect your free speech rights at EFF.org.
So, we want to inject feeling into our story. And we want to do this by setting expectations that a certain thing could happen that would produce that particular feeling. Okay. Here's how we accomplish that. First, we have to identify which feeling we want to inject in the story. We want to identify which feeling do we want the story to invoke. Okay? Then ask, what would make our main character, our protagonist, feel that way? The audience is going to identify more with the protagonist than with his own feelings. At least if we've established sympathy for the protagonist. If we have a sympathetic character, the audience is going to identify with that character. So, think, what would make that character feel that way? Then, give that character a solid reason to believe that this particular thing, whatever it is that will make them feel the way we want the story to feel, make that thing an expected outcome. So, for example, let's say we want the story to feel hopeful. We'll take our sympathetic character and ask ourselves, what does this character want? Then find some way to promise that he'll get it. Make the character think he's going to get, or at least that he could get, what he wants. He will be hopeful, and your audience will just be hopeful along with him. A variation on this is not to let the character know what's happening, but do let the audience know. So, let the audience know that the character can get what he wants, or at least let the audience think that the character can get what he wants or is likely to get what he wants, and they will be hopeful for him. So a variation on the procedure would be identify the feeling that we want to inject into the story, then ask what situation would our sympathetic character need to be in for the audience to feel that way. What would make the audience feel that way? And usually this is a situation of the sort where if the character only knew what was ahead of him, he would feel differently than he does. The audience knows more than the character does. So then, let the audience know the information they need to know to be afraid for the character or hopeful for the character or whatever the feeling is that we want to invoke, let them feel that way for the character. I've thrown together a couple of flash stories that demonstrate these, and I'll post them in the blog entry on BeTheStory.com. You know, we all have only a certain limited amount of time in the day, and there are so many great podcasts out there. I know, you know, my list of podcasts that I'd like to listen to, so long, I clearly will never get the chance to listen to all of them. So, thank you for deciding to listen to this one. Next week, I'll continue the series on setting the mood. I'll see you then. Bye.